of critical systems and habitat priorities. She's already gasping, Alex. We're right on the edge. We have one chance to attack the Maputo, and then we're heading for the Vermelho Sea.
Solomon mimicked her shrug.
Then the Steelback will have to sub in, supported by the Iron Claw. I'll authorize the sentience upgrade across all squadrons in the Mid-Ath Theater. Forgive my ignorance, said Avery. But this whole attack depends on the skills of Inferno X and Enhanced Drakes, depleted though the squadron is, to create a gap that ground forces and supporting squadrons from all three behemoths can exploit. You are advocating removing a third of the firepower and the most influential Drake squadron from the battle. We cannot bring down the Maputo that way. Then get me Halloran. Quickly. Otherwise your fellow commanders will have to find a way to prove you wrong.
I don't get it, said Avery. This is the break you and Corsini have been fighting for. If we take out the Maputo, we will see victory in less than a year.
Believe me, if someone else picks up Halloran, there will be no victory. None of us will see the end of the war.
He's one man, said Muller, aware that Kirby's silence meant he knew something Avery and Muller didn't.
Like as not, he'll be dead in a day. His Drake has minimal nutrients. Max is starving, and there's nothing within exhaustion range. As Nick said, if we don't find him, his chances of survival are minimal to vanishing.
Even if he dies, no one salvages his body or his Drake but us, said Solomon. No one examines them but Markov. News of their escape does not leave this behemoth. Otherwise, we'll have a shitstorm on the back of a fireball to deal with. Make your staff aware. Whatever they think they know, they keep it to themselves.
He's a rogue pilot. It's hardly a PR disaster, is it? The public have seen it before, and like all the others, he'll die in the pouch.
Muller stopped when he felt Kirby's and Solomon's eyes on him. The pieces started dropping into place.
You don't think he'll die, do you? You think he'll survive the fall.
What? Said Avery.
Solomon and Kirby glanced at each other, and Solomon gave the slightest shrug and the curtest of nods. Kirby spoke.
Yes, we do. He's a perfect, if difficult, test subject. Halloran has a uniquely strong physiology and brain chemistry combination. Why do you think Markov relocated here a few months ago? Why do you think Alex is here and the upgrade was pushed through? Then why did you chuck him in landfill? Because he was about to expose everything. And if we couldn't monitor him in pouch, we could still do critical research in landfill. Simple, really, said Kirby.
You talk about him as if he's some kind of experiment.
Don't be so naive, Gerhard, said Solomon. They're all experiments. We know everything about every pilot.
Muller felt a chill across his back.
Monitoring and measuring is one thing. Experimenting on them to further your ambitions? That's something else entirely. This mess is a direct result of your misguided interventions.
Solomon stared at him, and the pity in her eyes made him want to punch her teeth in. Instead, he sat in silence while Kirby swelled with glee.
And you want to be a behemoth, Commander? My advice? Get your head out of the Drake's arse it's been stuck in. God's holy prick, Nicola. Where do you get your execs from? The idiot tree?
Muller felt his cheeks reddening.
Fine, he said calmly, using every mote of his experience to remain so. I'm not a political animal, but I am also the most effective flight commander in UE. Do you want to win this war, or just carry on playing your power games?
The fact that you think they're incompatible rather makes my point, said Solomon.
I'm not with you, said Muller.
Solomon rolled her eyes.
We can agree on that, at least. Let me lay it out for you. I know the potential of every pilot in the service. Every single one. So does Markov.
And on the hog, so do Avery and Kirby. Pilots with particular skills are gathered together for closer analysis across the fleet.
Muller winced. He'd known IX were special, but he'd never asked himself why.
Every behemoth needs a gun squadron, the flag carrier more than any other. I didn't realize they were a mere experiment, he said.
Their skill is certainly a bonus when it comes to skinning enemy drakes, but it doesn't end there.
Solomon sucked her top lip a moment, then began to count off on her fingers.
Orin, Iron Mind, her longevity is unparalleled. We've been experimenting with her endurance, trying to mimic her brain patterns for 11 months now. Stepanek's reactions are stunning. His synaptic velocity is off the scale. Something in Redfern's mind mimics mind shielding. We don't know how yet, but we think her mind might be even stronger than Orin's. Have you seen how smoothly Monteith flies? Something in his neural pathways and specific muscle chemistry gives him extraordinary control over his movements. Want me to go on? Everyone in that squad has a unique strength. We're working to develop it, clone it, and roll it out as an upgrade for every pilot.
And you think Max can survive the fall?
He is the distillation of every other pilot in Inferno X. If we can capture and share his strengths, we'll win this war.
Muller cursed himself for his naivety.
This upgrade's all part of it, isn't it? Not just a financial win.
Now you're getting it, said Kirby.
But unshielded, it's not research and experimentation. It's gambling.
It's a calculated risk, said Kirby.
Muller laughed. He couldn't help himself.
But if it fails, you've tossed all of Inferno X away.
Kirby shrugged, and Muller almost punched him then and there.
It's inevitable that the throughput of pilots will increase. But remember, we save money on both time and training new jockeys.
Muller sat back in his chair. He felt like he was among strangers, listening to sedition, rather than meeting with people he'd worked with and mostly respected for years. But now he was on the outside, and it had only taken one word to convince him of that.
Throughput, he snarled. You're not fit to be the XO. These are human beings, you soul-sucking, heartless reptile.
Yeah, that's right, said Kirby, leaning in so Muller had the full measure of his contempt. Human beings who watch vids of poster boys like Max and cannot sign on fast enough. They're ours, and even if the Inferno X experiment plays out badly, we'll have so many willing to take their re-engineered drinks that the Maths and the Sambas will wilt under the barrage. But if this works, and we have Max out there, a true Drake pair, maybe others from Inferno will survive the fall with him. We'll be unstoppable. We can't lose. So long as no one learns our pilots are surviving the fall, and that by default we had to be complicit in their survival. You do get that, don't you? That's why we have to get Max back here, alive or dead.
Muller's peepalm bleeped, and he snapped it open, rather than spend another second watching Kirby. Yarif had sent him a vid from all the newsnets in UE.
Too late,
said Muller, and swiped it up to the big screen. It was a little shaky, but there was no doubting the insignia in the background. There was an icy silence as they watched high-definition sound and video of Martha demolishing her pen door, and then taking off with that disconcerting drunken stagger.
There goes your poster boy.
Solomon turned from the screen, and her face was a snarl.
Fuck you, Muller.
Chapter 29. Funny how times change. The sky used to be full of planes and helicopters. There are still a few left, powered by biofuel, but shit do they look weird chugging around up there. Clumsy, no grace, and seriously vulnerable too. The Drake. That's the way to fly. Max Halloran. Valera had taken one look at Kalani and knew why Grimm had looked so scared. She was going downhill fast. The heaters were doing their work, but she needed physical contact with her Drake. Valera hoped she'd be capable of walking as far as the flight deck when the time came.
"I don't get it, Skipper," said Grimm. "It came on like someone flicked a switch."
Kalani was sitting up in bed, her face grey and with a tick in her left eye. To the casual observer, it probably looked like a bad cold.
"How's the head, Risa?"
Kalani's eyes swam towards her.
"I can barely hear you. The roaring inside is so loud. It's full of fluid, sloshing like a tank, too full of sludge. I can't focus. I need my Drake."
Valera put her hand on Risa's clammy one.
"You've got to hang on. They can't keep us in lockdown forever. The Maputo attack is imminent, and we're the Arrowhead."
"I thought the heaters would stop this," said Kalani. "Would make me feel normal."
"Yeah, but flying your Drake's the other half of the equation, right? We all get more and more grouchy the longer we're away from our Drakes, but it's worse for you. Reach out, see if you can touch minds, but do it carefully."
"I'm not sure I can project through the sludge," said Kalani, smiling feebly. "I'll give it a shot."
"None of us is an expert," said Valera gently. "We all have to find our own way. Remember, IX is with you the whole time, okay?"
Kalani gripped Valera's hand and squeezed it, then jerked back at the sound of a huge cheer from the squad wreck. Valera heard wild whoops and the slap of high fives, and Max's name was trumpeted loud and long. Footsteps pounded towards Kalani's door, and it was thrust open.
"You have got to see this!"
Monteith pointed at Kalani.
"Want a lift?"
"If you're asking if I'd like to arrive in a style befitting a woman of my importance, then yes. A lift would be lovely."
Monteith flashed that awesome, melting smile of his.
"That is, of course, precisely what I am asking. May I?"
"You may."
Monteith knelt by the bed, put his arms beneath her knees and shoulders, and lifted her in one easy motion. The squad wreck had gone quiet, and Valera led the way out to find them all staring at her, the anticipation burning them like kids at Christmas. There was an image of Flight Deck Alpha on the big screen with a pause symbol across it. Monteith sat Kalani front and centre, and the squad grouped around her, Valera and Grimm sandwiching her.
"What happened? Did Kirby fall off the gantry or something?"
asked Valera.
"Because that would be such a shame."
"Oh, it's much, much better than that," said Stepanek. "Tap it, Reds."
The pause symbol disappeared, and Valera watched with increasing excitement and a very comforting sense of validation as Max's escape played out on the screen. The sequence ended to more whoops, cheers, and high fives. Beside her, Kalani had tears rolling down her cheeks, but her eyes were clearer. Grimm was sobbing through the broadest smile Valera had seen in days.
"Did you ever doubt he'd do it?"
Monteith's face was huge in Valera's vision when he bellowed the question. She laughed and pushed him away.
"It's so good to see him actually do it, though. Tell me, is this ship only, or has it gone wide?"
"It's on every news net across UE," said Calder. "Can't believe there wasn't a blackout in place."
"I'm sure there is," said Valera. "This is going to cause some serious ripples."
She pushed herself from her seat and headed for her usual place.
"Okay, IX," said Stepanek. "Looks like the skipper's got a few things to say."
The squad moved quickly to their seats, still buzzing from the video. Stepanek ordered quiet.
"We have to plan fast, before Kirby's puppets are banging on our door," said Valera. "Can they break the encryption on our comms?"
"Not a chance," said Gurney. "We bounced every word around more parts of the central core than Max has notches on his bedpost. And we put in that hide-and-seek subroutine the Blammers sold me that sends the messages further into the murk if a trace is put out. It's really bloody clever."
So, what happens when they break the regs and take our peepalms away for analysis?
Gurney shrugged.
It'll get them nothing. Every encrypted message is on auto-delete. Every peepalm scrambles each screen tap to defeat keystroke analysis. I'll check everyone's kit to make sure, but there's really nothing to worry about.
Good. Valera felt a little better. And all of you, plausible deniability. We were all in lockdown, so we couldn't communicate with anyone, all right? Don't go getting pissed and mouthing off. Moving on. Calder, we need to set up contact with Max if we can. He'll have dumped his locators, or they'd have caught him by now. How do we type beam him?
Calder pushed her hands through her hair.
I've got some comms kit stripped out of an old suit of mine somewhere. Think if we can patch it into the ship's comms via the old wall buttons, we might be able to piggyback the array. Detectability? Minuscule chance. So many comms in and out, it'd be virtually impossible to strip out one. How long will it take?
Calder shrugged.
I don't even know it's possible yet.
Valera smiled.
Fair enough. Best get to it. We don't know how much time we've got before Kirby comes a-calling, or we get put back on flight duty. What's going to happen to him?
Grimm's question bled the euphoria from the squad room like a knife to the throat, and every eye turned to Valera, searching for hope. She wanted to give it to them, but she wasn't a bullshitter. Never had been.
Without help, you know he's got little chance out there, she said. But there was no other choice. We don't know much about Max's condition, barring how fit he is and how strong his spirit is. But he's going to be living with Martha 24/7. We can all do the maths.
That bastard better not beat me into the fall, said Kalani.
Laughter fed around the squad room, easing the pain of knowledge.
Can't he leave me to be better at one thing than him?
Wouldn't really be him, would it? Said Monteith. Got no chance, has he? Said Gurney.
But this is Max, said Valera,
wishing greater strength on him than even he possessed.
He might even survive it. That's why I want contact. Then at least we can be with him on whatever journey he takes. It's the best we can hope for.
It was mid-morning on the second day of the hunt for Max Halloran, and the bridge was starting to smell. Nothing overpowering or nauseating, but for those who worked there day by day, it was a warning that shouldn't be ignored. It was the smell that signified a behemoth operating beyond its safe working parameters, that the Heart of Granite should be making best speed to the Vermelo Sea for a regeneration cycle, not running combat sorties. Commander Avery paused by the brain and laid a hand gently on the shoulder of one of the breadheads. Lieutenant Sally Hall started, her hands still making their delicate adjustments, a faraway look in her eyes.
"Just a quick one. I can see you're wired in right now," she said. "How's the texture?" "Dry," she said. "Synaptic connection is slow. Slower. You'll have to check with Biosystems Integration, but she feels proper creaky, like she's been on an all-nighter, you know? How long are we staying here?"
Avery pursed her lips.
"Just be gentle with her, all right?"
"Yes, ma'am."
Avery strode to the command screens, seeing the buckets positioned on the floor to catch the odd drip of visceral fluid plopping down from the bone-metal interfaces. She took in the active Drake cams relaying the hunt for Halloran. Flamehawk G and Firestorm E were grid-searching. Avery's eye was caught by two stationary cameras. She noted the call signs under the cams and patched herself into the squadcom.
"Jazz G, Cal G, this is Avery."
"Copy, ma'am," they replied.
"Why are you on the ground?"
"This is the farthest north confirmed landing point," said Jazz G.
"He was here. Footprints of man and Drake. Evidence of flame on the ground. Hold on, ma'am. Kelly, hold that up to my cam."
Avery sighed. It was a fused black mass, small and melted, almost unrecognizable from its original form.
"You reading that, Commander?"
asked Jasmine.
"Copy, Jazz G. Now we knew it didn't fail."
"Never very likely," said Kelly.
"No, indeed. He must have found a bleed. Complete your sweep and come back. We've got some poor weather coming in from the east at dusk."
"Copy, ma'am."
Avery put her headset down on the tack table and looked across the command consoles to Muller. Since learning the truth, the man had aged 10 years.
Gerhardt.
Muller straightened and told whoever he was talking to out in the field to stand by.
The Hammerclaws are on approach. I need to get back to flight command.
Avery nodded.
He can't just have vanished, and there's nowhere to hide. Why haven't we found him? The comms should have picked up something.
Well, we only know his position until he went dark. It was another hour before we got there, and in that time he could have gone anywhere. We've covered 300 square clicks, and we haven't scratched the surface.
Think he's hiding?
Where? I think he'll fly east or west as far as he can, and then he'll try to find shelter.
Then what?
Asked Avery.
Unless he finds sanctuary, he'll die.
Commander?
Avery swung round sharply.
Biosystems and integrated systems update. It's ugly stuff. Want a precy?
Yes, she said, relaxing. Go ahead, Dr. Rosenbach.
Sitting here all night has accelerated the existing problems. Being stationary has played havoc with her digestive system, blood pressure, and musculoskeletal linkages. We've got tension in ligaments and cramps in major muscle groups. If we sit here another 2 days, we'll have to drag her to the Vermelo Sea.
What about life systems?
That depends on how long we're staying here and whether we still plan to hunt the Maputo or not.
Assume that we are.
Then it's going to get uncomfortable. To keep ground and air assets in combat condition, we'll have to divert power from the core life systems. Even so, we'll struggle to deliver peak nutrient levels to any of our assets. The hog is already on reduced absorption. Combine that with her digestive inefficiency. She's been excreting undigested proteins for some days now, and we'll be in emergency conditions within 48 hours.
You're lucky I'm not one to shoot the messenger.
It's not that. Well, it is. It's that, well, while we can do the standing exercise routines with the heart...
Yes, we've all enjoyed her gyrating on the spot and the rotational leg lift boogie.
Rosenbach grimaced.
It's not enough. Standing still places stress on the spine and allows lactic acid to build up in the key joints. That affects the 40 mils and the spin-up of the rocket sheds. We're talking artillery jams already.
Avery scratched her forehead.
Anything else?
Rosenbach tapped her P-palm, and Avery's pinged as it received the report file.
You said there was bad weather on the way.
An almighty sandstorm is hitting us just after dusk. Winds in excess of 110. We'll be locked tight for tonight and well into tomorrow. Satellite comms will be degraded or non-existent.
If the sandstorm lasts more than 12 hours, battery charge will be so low, we'll have to head east immediately.
She knew it shouldn't have, but the news actually cheered Avery. Something to force Solomon's hand, perhaps. Then again, she'd probably have the crew attach ropes to the heart and pull her into battle.
Thank you. I'll take your findings and recommendations to the Marshal General.
Thank you, Commander.
Is Professor Markov back on board?
Arrived about 3 hours ago from the Steelback. She's briefed and, well, you know, irritable.
Avery laughed.
I wouldn't have it any other way. Perhaps you'd like to direct her ire towards Kirby or the Marshal Jen in the first instance. Up here, we're just trying to sweep up their mess.
Chapter 30. To guide a subject successfully through the fall would move the course of human evolution in a new and exciting direction that would benefit us all. To say it would move us further from God is arrant nonsense, based on groundless fears and a slavish adherence to ancient writings of dubious provenance. Professor Helena Markov, ERC Lecture Program. Corsini was at his desk, and it looked as if he hadn't slept. Crumpled suit, unshaven, unkempt hair, and his eyes were red-rimmed, but bright.
"Been on the double O's again, Gilles?"
asked Solomon, settling down at her desk in her quarters and facing him through a desktop screen. She'd taken the precaution of appearing a little ragged herself, no point in pumping up his self-righteous indignation further than it was already bound to be.
"I'm guessing you've either found a new intern to screw, or the crowds have got a little large on the front lawn."
Corsini said nothing, but his face flushed a deeper shade of absolutely furious. He picked up his screen, and Solomon was treated to a jumble of jittering office imagery before he pointed it through his large bay window at the crowd below. Actually, it was less a crowd at the gates of the presidential residence, more of a howling mob, in front of whom a group of security personnel stood filming everyone and everything that they did. Corsini held the screen there until the mob noticed him and began hurling abuse and missiles in his direction. A couple of half-bricks bounced from the windows. Corsini didn't flinch. Solomon assumed he must be used to it. He walked back to his desk and replaced the screen in its cradle before sitting down.
"All right, so people are unhappy," said Solomon. "Just for context, how many demonstrators are out there on a normal day?"
Corsini shrugged.
30 to 40, usually religious nuts, a few peace protesters and the Luddite Brigade."
"I see.
There had to be 500 people out there today."
"I'll never ever say this again, but I'm sorry the events on the Heart of Granite have affected you in this way."
Corsini gave a harsh laugh.
"If it was just them, I wouldn't care. Unfortunately, the news nets are running outrageous conspiracy theories 24/7, so I'm having to host a series of meetings to convince them we are not actually running a fall research program, despite its proscription. They aren't buying the rogue Drake thing. No one is."
Solomon didn't reply at once. This was at the upper end of her PR fears, and the acceleration of the situation was spectacular. If this got any worse, Corsini would shut them down, forcing him into inevitably disastrous diplomatic moves.
"The truth is that Halloran was in landfill after exhibiting the early stages of the fall. He broke out, escaped, and will be recaptured within the next 24 hours.
Corsini stared straight down the barrel of the screen.
"No one, but no one, gives a shit about any of that. You're telling me the story I specifically said no one was buying."
"You asked for the truth,"
said Solomon, feeling an unusual sensation of discomfort.
"And I'm still waiting for it. I also speak regularly to Professor Markov because, for very obvious reasons, I have to keep a forensic watch on Cerberus. We are playing a very dangerous game here."
Solomon made to speak, but Corsini raised a hand.
"Let's assume I'm not a total idiot. Although I invited you to run the latest upgrade, I do not recall sanctioning live fall survival testing. So, let's try the truth again, shall we?"
Corsini was enjoying himself despite his situation.
"Halloran found out more than he should and had to be silenced. No one has sanctioned Cerberus survival testing."
"Well, congratulations on a monumental screw-up, then. Because it's starting to look like Halloran did it for himself. Promise me you're about to recapture him."
"I can't do that. His locators are gone, his cams are gone. He's disappeared."
Corsini leaned right into the screen.
"It's a fucking desert, Alex. And he's flying a 30-meter-long fire drake. How hard can it be?"
"It's a fucking big desert, and he could have gone anywhere. Now there's a major storm on the way. Even if he survived this long, a sandstorm will finish him off."
"You'd better pray you're right, because if he falls and survives and word gets out, I'll lose the election, if I last in office that long."
"I'm aware of the risks,"
said Solomon, feeling an unwelcome flush in her face.
"You know, Alex, I really don't think you are."
The silence was growing ever more agonizing. And as much as they told themselves contact was extremely unlikely, the specter of hope was within each one of them, and the longer they were denied what they wanted, the harder it got. Valera almost wished she hadn't asked Calder to put the comms package together in the first place. The rig was in her pod, and wires trailed out of the door, where they hooked into the old ship's comm through which Calder had managed to access the main wide-beam comm system and hide their signal amid the mass of traffic in and out of the behemoth. Valera took a breath and tried again.
Hal X, Val X, if you copy, please respond. Max, there's bad weather racing in from the east. Gale force winds have kicked up a sandstorm. You need to find shelter urgently.
Tears suddenly threatened, and her voice wobbled.
Please, Max, respond. We need to know you're alive. We want to help you. Hang in there, Hal X.
Nothing. Not even static clicks or wind rush. Valera looked up at Stepanek, expecting to see denial, but he shrugged.
He's a little bastard, but he gets to you, doesn't he? Gotta respect what he tried to do, and I hate it that I can't help.
We have to believe we still can,
said Valera, wiping her eyes with the heels of her palms.
How? Asked Stepanek. He's got nowhere to go.
Footsteps, warned Redfern from outside. Multiple, approaching fast. Calder,
Valera snapped her fingers.
Reds, get clear. Grim, get out of sight and stay in here.
Calder yanked on the wires, pulling them from the behemoth's comm. She bundled them up with the old suit comm unit and was stuffing them into Valera's cupboard when the squad door opened, slapping against the bone wall.
Don't you people ever knock?
Asked Redfern from outside, just before Valera opened her pod door to confront the intruders.
I don't need your permission, said Kirby. Get your squad into the wreck right now.
Valera stepped out into the corridor, coming uncomfortably close to the XO.
You're rather in my way, sir,
she said, her mind full of the joy she'd take from kicking him straight in his balls.
Reds, get the squad all neat and tidy, would you? I'd hate to disappoint the XO.
Kirby was forced to move back, close to Hewitt and Anderson. Valera smiled sweetly and led Kalani and the others out of her pod.
What were you doing in there?
Demanded Kirby, walking close behind them.
Group sex, sir, said Valera. What else is there to do?
Valera sat in her usual place, smiling at her squad, all standing to attention like they were about to meet the new teacher at school. Kirby would know it was a hair from an insult, but that he could do nothing about it.
Have a seat, sir.
Stepanek was smiling at Anderson.
Dental work going okay?
You will hold your tongue, snapped Kirby.
He didn't sit down.
The fact is, I need your help. Halloran is going to die out there, and the coming storm means we have little time. He's weak and sick, and so is his Drake. We can save his life, so let's put aside who did what to help who. Tell me where he's hiding, and we'll go get them both. Squad's like family, right? So do the right thing by him.
Kirby stared squarely at Valera, and she met his gaze while she tried to unpick how she was feeling.
How can we know where he's gone, sir?
She said, keeping her voice deliberately calm and even.
We've had no way of contacting him since you threw him in landfill.
Kirby spread his hands.
I just don't believe you. It's preposterous to think that none of you helped Halloran. Plainly, Grimaldi had her orders, and I presume she's here somewhere. Perhaps I'll take her in for more detailed questioning in advance of her official hearing. She or one of the pilots from landfill will talk, and then I'll have what I want. So, last chance, Inferno X. Speak up. Save Max.
Kalani twitched, but said nothing. Kirby smiled horribly and turned his focus on her.
And then there's you, Pilot Risa Kalani. A couple of things were brought to my attention. A little note Muller made about your condition in what he thinks is a private log. A bit of footage from the flight deck that came my way. Makes me wonder if you aren't hiding something rather more serious than a bang on the head.
I'm fine, sir, and I've had a brain pattern scan since.
Still, as XO, I wonder if a couple of days under test in landfill would show that you're falling. But, you know, I'm not without heart. None of these things has to happen, so long as I get enough intel to lead me to Halloran. You know how things are. I'm a busy man, prone to forgetting trivialities.
Kalani stood up immediately and gave Valera a hug, speaking softly into her ear at the same time.
Get Max. He can save me.
Valera froze, realizing what Kalani intended, and not seeing a better option.
Best you take me for testing. Better to be safe, right?
Kirby was plainly off balance.
What?
Kalani smiled.
Oh dear. No other bargaining chip. What's your next play, sir? Thing is, even if we knew anything, none of us would talk. And, you know, the only people tougher than Drake pilots are the flight crew.
Kirby stared at her.
You're making the biggest mistake of your short life.
Kalani shrugged and pointed.
Landfill's up in the skull. Want me to show you the way?
Chapter 31. There is no chat-up line in the world that can beat, "I'm Max. I'm a Fire Drake pilot." Maximus Halloran. They'd all been looking in the wrong place. Every pilot knew where they'd go if they went rogue, and none of them would ever tell command. So the squadron searched the ground for every likely hiding place, just as they'd been ordered, and none were surprised they didn't find him. The groundbound always thought in two dimensions, and were arrogant enough to think a pilot would do the same. So while ground and air lizards were tasked with searching every centimetre of sand and the few areas of cover it contained, Max and Martha were flying very high, floating on the upper thermals, their energy use minimal, their peace complete, though sadly temporary. They had slept on the ground that first night. It was safe enough, though it had been cold, and Max had spent most of his time in Martha's pouch, feeling her shiver and her yearning for the heated pen that had been her home all her life. Yet he didn't sense any anger or regret, and he tried not to think too hard about why. Waking this morning had been an anxious affair. Max had half expected to be changed, to have fallen. But he wasn't, and didn't even feel weird. Not cold or hot, no blurred eyesight or seeing visions of blood and fire everywhere. But it wouldn't last. Not unless he could figure a way out of the mess he was in, and that didn't seem too likely. He'd ignored it all day while they rode the glorious high skies far to the east. But then Martha had begun to get edgy because she could sense something. It wasn't just that they were both getting tired again, and hungry. Bloody hell, Max was famished. It was more than that. Valera's voice over the comm had startled him after the day of static, and he'd listened while the yearning to be back among them grew. His family were still with him, and still hoping. He'd been desperate to respond, but knew that he could not. Not if there was the slightest chance of being tracked. So he listened and kept the memories of her voice to remind him who he was fighting for. Martha moaned a soft sound in her throat, half growl, half wail, and it hit him right in his heart. He wondered what she'd felt. Maybe a tensing in his muscles or something in his mind that he'd projected unconsciously. Whatever it was, it made him feel better. Less alone.
"We've got bigger problems than feeling sorry for ourselves, Princess," said Max. "We need a place to shelter. You can feel the change in the air, can't you?"
It was a stupid question. Way up here, Max could feel it through her wings and in the occasional gentle buffeting of her sleek body. The outriders of the oncoming gale were reaching out, prodding them, warning them to get clear. He turned Martha west, away from the storm, heading back in the direction of the Heart of Granite, feeling the tremor in her muscles and the tiredness in his making the turn a little jerky. He wondered what would happen if she reached her limit of exhaustion, whether she'd fall from the sky or choose to take over and land before both of them were killed. Best not to find out. The afternoon was on the wane, and Max estimated the sandstorm was about 2 hours behind him. By the time he was in the vicinity of the hog, she'd be locked down waiting for it to hit. They'd be scanning the radar for anything running in front of the storm, so he had to stay high and well to the north of her to stay in neutral territory. The Steelback and the Ironclaw would be moving up to take flank duties if the attack on the Maputo was still going ahead once the storm had blown itself out. It wouldn't do to stray into their search grids. The camel herd's shack came to mind, above which Anna Beth had met him during that fateful sky time. It was a ruin, but must have survived worse than what was coming. It had survived a war. And of course, that's where all this had started. Where Anna Beth had told him what was really going on. Part of him, a big part, wanted to take it all back and live in blissful ignorance. What he should have done was persuade her to land and take her to the old mattress he'd seen through holes in the roof. Surely there'd have been some spring left in it. It would have been beautiful. Alone in the desert, sex to the echoes of drake calls and the whip of the wind around the corners of the building. Her scent, the feel of her wrapped around him, the sounds she made and the rippling of her body. There'd have been no need for words, no need for all the pain. Max's eyes snapped open, and for a moment he was disoriented. His limbs jerked reflexively with the shock of sudden consciousness, and Martha squawked, her wings flaring and her legs jerking down. Max shuddered. He looked about him, using Martha's senses to assess his position. He'd been asleep. He knew that, but not for how long. The desert was largely featureless. He was high in the sky, and it all looked the same. He scanned for dust clouds to the north, anything to signify the movement of the Heart's sister behemoths, and there they were, moving up before the storm forced them to a stop. Max bit his lip. In his estimation, they should have been further away, and that is 11 o'clock, but they were a good deal closer and coming round to his 10. He felt a chill. He'd been asleep for ages, an hour at least. That was a lifetime in the pouch. Martha had flown on, his head-up display confirming she'd maintained height and direction. Whether she had assumed control directly was impossible to say, but the inevitable relaxation of his body hadn't altered her flight. "So, is this how it starts?" Max was half expecting to hear some stereotypical gravelly dragon voice say, "Yes." But of course there was nothing. Martha responded to his arms, trimming her attitude, beginning a long, slow descent. Max focused back on the ground far below, hoping to pick out a less obvious hiding place. A west-facing rocky outcrop would do. "Thanks for keeping us in the air," he said, sending thoughts of affection and happiness, and feeling Martha's warmth spread across his mind in response. "You must tell me how you did it one day." Martha gave her wings an extra beat. She shouldn't have been able to change her orders as set by his posture, the feel of his fingers or the positions of his arms and legs and the twitch of his muscles. If this was what the fall felt like, then there was nothing to fear. Max sobered. Of course that wasn't how it felt. The briefest thought of Risa Kalani, or the unfortunates in landfill, told him that. But was this the start? The merest change in the relationship easily glossed over by an involuntary movement or a stray thought. And Max was exhausted. There were bound to be consequences. It would be all right once he'd had a rest. "No lasting damage, Max. Nothing a good night's sleep won't fix. That's what you always say, Dad. That's because it's nearly always true. And what about when it isn't? I don't know, really. 2 good nights' sleep? "Damn it!" roared Max, trying to clear his head, angry he'd dozed off again so quickly. "We've got to get down on the deck, Princess. Don't think I can stay awake much longer." Fatigue was only part of the problem. Max's body ached all over. Most of his muscles were stiff, and his breathing felt a little constricted. He'd been in the pouch and flying for 10 hours straight, and that followed a night where he had only emerged at dawn to stretch out and take a piss. Never mind the disastrous implications for his mental state, he was seizing up physically. His head was pounding again, and he was hungry, and the hunger was making him weak in mind and body. And the thirst? Don't even start with how thirsty he was.
"Hey, Princess, can you hear me?"
Martha rocked her head from side to side in response to the images he sent, as much as to the sound of his voice.
"Might not make the old camel shack."
If she understood him, she didn't indicate it. Their gentle descent continued, and now Max had admitted his discomfort, it grew at a hyperbolic rate, and he feared his body wouldn't react the way he needed it to next time. They would soon be crossing the heart of Granite's Wake. He could see the gouges in the sand. The hog herself must be about 4 hours south. Martha's body rippled, and she rocked her head again from side to side. Max felt a freezing cold rush across his body, leaving his head feeling like it was encased in ice. He wanted to cry out, but there was nothing inside him to make a sound. On the back of the cold came fear, because this had to be the start of the fall, but it was washed away by the warmth in his mind despite the ice stuck in his veins. At the last, there were images, and his subconscious mind decoded them and provided him with a single word that blazed in his head. Trust. Max found his voice and screamed.
"Don't do it, Martha. You don't have to do it."
The feelings of cold had gone, but the following rush of heat caused brief, extreme agony. He'd screamed for the second time, and terror had rolled over him. He tried to push her away, shut her out of his mind. It was like trying to push sunlight. Max spoke to her, tried to persuade her to free him, to fly like they always had, but there was nothing in return.
"Haven't I always treated you well, Princess? We're friends, a team. We're in balance. Don't change it."
But she had changed it, and it had left him a passenger, a prisoner. She'd frozen the pouch, and no longer did his movements drive her. No longer did his thoughts influence her.
"Not yet, not yet, not yet!"
He'd been a pilot so short a time, and it wasn't like he'd been with her that long since his escape. He didn't understand it. Perhaps this wasn't the fall, but some precursor, some early symptom that would disappear as suddenly as it had come on. It didn't explain why Martha was in control, although maybe if he was having difficulties, something within her kicked in to keep them going. He clung on to the thought. It was all he had. Max felt abandoned, forgotten even. No, he felt betrayed, and he sent the emotion out as strongly as he could. Ice poured into his head again. He gasped, feeling the cold surge down his spine. The flood of emotions and images came again, coalescing in the repetition of the single word, trust.
"So you do know I'm still here," he said.
Martha purred.
"Let me back in. I can help."
She merely steepened their descent, flying in tight circles as if searching for something on the ground directly below her. Max looked too, seeing that they were above the hog's wake. The storm was closing faster, or that's how it felt. He could feel the gusts on Martha's flanks and wings. Max tried to move his arms. He splayed his fingers and tensed muscles, tiny twitches made large by the fatigue clouding him. Of course, none of it made any difference. Martha had already made the adjustments.
"Nothing down there but sand and shit," said Max. "We need a place to hole up, remember?"
In response, Martha barked. It was a sound of satisfaction, and she dived. The desert floor was barren but for mounds of behemoth feces, easily the most repulsive smell on the Holy Father's ruined earth.
"I'm not sure I can build a sandcastle large enough in time," said Max,
trying to quell his fear, trying to believe Martha's solitary word. Martha rattled phlegm along the length of her throat, the vibrations funneling into the pouch. She levelled out at about 50 and swept south along the tail trough. She had something in mind. Correction, Max hoped she had something in mind so they could ride out the storm. Max looked left and right, trying to work out what she wanted to do. Martha barked once more, dived down until she was almost touching the deck, backed her wings in front of a pile of dung larger than she was, and flew directly up to a couple of meters above it.
"Don't even think about it," said Max.
He clenched everything, praying she was just trying to find something to eat or track a scent or something, but it was more than that.
"Have you any idea what going in there would do to my sex life?"
Max's mind was bathed very briefly with thoughts of sustenance. A heartbeat later, a sheath slid over his face, sealing him in the pouch, and Martha dropped tail first straight into the dung. There was a disgusting squelching sound, the sensations of Martha working her way ever deeper into the mound, and using her wings to gather more about her, and finally plunging her head into the filthy mid-green sludge. Max's last thought was how he was going to breathe in the sealed pouch, but a sharp impact at the base of his spine and a second one at the base of his neck were followed very swiftly by a floating, nightmare-fueled oblivion. Professor Helena Markov was irritable. Incompetence had that effect on her, and this particular instance was uniquely piquing. Because, having got here, on a bloody gecko of all things, and reviewed the whole sorry saga, it was clear that no one was actually to blame, just some amorphous them that had organised the whole thing and outwitted the internal security might of the flag-carrying behemoth. So they sat around a table, and she became increasingly frustrated at the bullet-dodging antics of Kirby and Muller. In the end, she smoothed down her creased brown fatigues, pushed her long black hair back into a ponytail, and cleared her throat into a momentary pause to ensure that the two of them were paying her the correct level of attention.
"I get it. You don't know where Halloran is. What exactly are you expecting of me?"
"We felt you needed context in order to bring your skills to bear most effectively," said Kirby.
Markov sighed.
"You sound like a role player in a training vid, Robert. It's me, Helena. Just talk to me like we've known each other for the last 5 years, why don't you?"
Kirby smiled for the first time since they'd sat down over their informal drinks in the otherwise deserted bridge bar, as the afternoon waned towards dusk and the winds grew in strength.
"Sorry. Guilty."
"I'm not smiling. My signature's been forged on an upgrade approval. I'll bring anyone else down I can if it comes to it," said Markov.
Their reactions were enlightening.
"You didn't know?"
Kirby shook his head.
"Why would we?"
Markov didn't know whether to believe him or not.
"That makes this the most senior of crimes, then."
"How far was the upgrade from being ready?"
asked Muller.
"How much risk is there to my pilots? Robert told me it was designed as a precursor to fall testing."
"He's right, and it depends on your definition of risk."
Muller frowned.
"Definition? You need me to spell it out?"
"I can't stop pilots going through the fall," said Markov. "It's only ever a question of time, so there's no way to mitigate the risk you're talking about. That's the problem. My primary role is to develop the conditions that allow pilots to survive the fall. What else can it be?"
Muller gaped, and it would have been comical if it weren't so sad.
"You're cold. What about methods to ensure they never hit the fall in the first place?"
"Can't be done. That's something we have managed to prove. We can't even delay it, but we can hide the symptoms and, perhaps most usefully, accelerate it."
"And that's why you want him back? For analysis?"
"I never wanted him to go in the first place," replied Markov. "He isn't ready yet."
Muller's contempt was embarrassing to behold.
"And when will he be ready?"
He even made the quote marks gesture with his fingers. Markov tensed and decided to take a sip of her warm and uninviting synthesized white wine before speaking.
"Let me tell you a little tale," she said sweetly. "It's about a man who sat on the Conflict Budget Committee 4 years ago and made an impassioned speech about the risks to Drake pilots and how further research could only lead to more risks as scientists sought to make Drakes ever more effective. That the current level of Drake sentience was entirely adequate to win the war, and that current treatments of early symptoms of the fall would evolve organically through medical analysis. As a direct result, 75% of the ERC's research budget was diverted to materials, training, and medical care. But the clamor for fall drugs didn't diminish, did it? It simply went underground, and all the best research on drugs to mitigate fall symptoms is now done on the black market. It also effectively halted research into surviving the fall,
and we were left with a grand data-gathering exercise in the hope suitable subjects might suggest themselves. But you knew all that, didn't you, Gerhardt?
I know that there is a limit to how far mixed DNA experimentation can be allowed to go, and I stopped you going over that line.
But there was no real conviction in his voice.
Right. Your paternal side is happier to see them subside into madness than potentially become something far greater.
I know where you were heading with it, so please don't take the holier-than-thou route with me, said Muller. The number of young souls you were willing to sacrifice on the altar of your research was staggering. And I wasn't alone, was I? How many of your precious team walked away even before the funding was cut?
Markov shrugged.
Being a scientist, particularly in pressurized military research, requires courage, and some people don't have it. I have to make decisions that might affect one life, but prolong or save 1,000 others. I feel no guilt, but yours eats you, doesn't it? You condemned all of your precious pilots to the fall, one after another.
Markov could see the fight leave him, and almost felt sorry for him. He swallowed the rest of his gin and signaled for another round.
No one thought the war would go on so long,
he said quietly. Markov gave a brief smile.
So, now that we've established that I'm always right and you two are always wrong, let's move on to how I can help.
The Hart's PA announced the sealing of the behemoth in advance of the imminent arrival of the sandstorm. Soon she'd shuffle round to keep her head away from the winds.
"Can he survive this?"
asked Muller.
"Assuming shelter, of course."
"I've reviewed the data, well, what little data you have, and it's by no means certain he survived so far. We have to assume that Halloran is smart enough to have selected a low-expenditure environment, so either he's under a rock, or he's been on the upper thermals during daylight."
Both men reacted, and Markov pursed her lips.
"Upper thermals it is, then,"
she said, noting another victory with the slightest of smiles.
"That would indicate he's been in the pouch a considerable number of consecutive hours, and probably at night, too, because his drake will need to share his body heat or be sluggish at dawn."
Markov did some quick calculations.
"Halloran's only been flying combat for 9 months, so we can discount any effects from that. However, he's now been in pouch for large parts of 2 days, and come morning, 2 nights, in a drake with an unshielded upgrade. Factoring in the exponentially increasing risks of consecutive hours in the pouch, plus the upgrade and his helpful daily named pill mix, I'd say he is roughly 85% likely to be in stage 3 fall 24 hours from now. He and his drake must be returned here for analysis, alive or dead. I mean, this is beyond the wildest dreams of any ERC scientist. It's like 10 years of data in a sparkly wrapper given to me on my birthday. I sincerely hope you can find him now I've told you where to look."
"You're actually happy he's out there, aren't you?"
"I'd have liked it done under more controlled circumstances, Gerhardt, but I'd be lying if I said I'm not excited about what might come back from the desert. Hal X is our most likely candidate to survive the fall."
A fly landed on the tabletop to drink from a spilled drop. With impressive speed, Muller swatted it with an open palm. He lifted his hand to flick away the carcass. It sparked once, faintly. They froze and stared at each other to confirm what each of them had seen.
"Oh, fuck," said Kirby.
"My lab," said Markov. "Now."
Chapter 32. Anyone who thinks they've taken a lungful of the worst stink in the world has never been within a click of behemoth shit. Maximus Halloran. Max thought he could hear voices. They were just out of reach, like claws appearing briefly from darkness to beckon him on, but it was too dim to follow. The voices would fade, and he would shout after them, but the sound was so muffled that they probably couldn't hear him.
He
He opened his eyes and was immediately reminded that it was better to keep them closed. For starters, there was nothing to see, and for another thing, his eyes ached whenever he opened them. The only problem with keeping them closed was the vivid images that played across his eyelids. There were worlds aflame and lands stained red. Max knew what was happening. He'd fought it at first, tried to get Martha to fly out of the filthy sludge and let him go, but in his heart, he knew she couldn't.